A year had passed since the coup, but March 18, 1971, the anniversary of Norodom Sihanouk's removal, bore little resemblance to the hastily organised, but sometimes genuine, outpouring of joy that had once filled the streets of Phnom Penh. In the wake of terrorist attacks that had rocked the capital in late January, public demonstrations were banned. One reporter described the sparse display of flags on public buildings, the government's minimal acknowledgement of the day that marked the beginning of their Khmer Republic, as exuding an air of vigilance. One French resident of the city reported that the streets were almost empty and the shops were closed. Citizens watched military patrols walking on the sidewalks while armoured cars periodically made their way up or down the city's wide boulevards. It wasn't a parade, it was just a new normal. The only official ceremony was attended by 100 or so people down near the National Assembly. Elsewhere, leaflets were airdropped to convey the political message of the day. A Khmer farmer with a pitchfork ejecting a Vietnamese man, recognisable by his conical hat. Not particularly subtle, but neither is airdropping leaflets. A year earlier, citizens of Phnom Penh had begun the inconvenient task, given the sheer weight, of having to take down all of the pictures of Sihanouk. Once they realised he would not be coming back anytime soon and his legal status had been effectively removed once he had been sentenced to death in absentia, which, in terms of presents, would be something like having to take down all of the depictions of Santa Claus during the Christmas holidays. Even Sihanouk's word of the day had to be removed from the newspapers. The country had been fully plunged into the icy ocean of war after having only gingerly lingered in the shallows for a few years prior. Although, things could have been worse. Many of the residents of Phnom Penh, although there were already hundreds of thousands more, those temporarily making it their home after fleeing the war and bombs in the countryside, well, everyone wasn't suffering noticeable shortages of food or fuel, or the general kind of goods that they were used to. And while many of the roads to the provinces were unsafe to travel on, everyone was glad that the enemy had at least not decided to launch some kind of major offensive in the dry season, which was the time when, if they were going to do it, they would have done it. Yes, it could have been worse, but it was an ominous time to be in the capital. Having a year to reflect on what had happened since Sihanouk was gone, and particularly because the current leader, the man who had assumed the role in the wake of the abolition of the monarchy, Lon Nol, wasn't even in the country. He was still recuperating in Hawaii from the stroke that he had suffered in February. As strokes go, it had only been mild. He was recovering and had only been seriously ill for less than a week. But it had still been deemed necessary for him to be relocated to the Tripler Army Hospital in Honolulu. News reports from around the 15th of February have him out of bed and walking with assistance, showing progress in his rehabilitation program. By March 11th, he is moved to a guest house at an Air Force base to continue his recovery. And if we had the ability to do a bit of a performance review on the first year since Lon Nol had been in power, well, it wouldn't be looking particularly good. Even if we exclude the initial flurry of blows that his post-coup government had been on the end of, which, you know, perhaps we could consider that, you know, in the still learning the ropes phase. But you'll recall during this opening phase, the gambit they had gone with was to begin a pogrom against the Vietnamese population generally in Cambodia, which was certainly an ugly and some might consider irredeemable course to choose. And then, as we saw in the last episode, in the aftermath of the US incursion into the country, which, when he had been informed it would be a limited incursion and that the US troops would leave in June, he burst into tears in front of Nixon's visiting chief of staff. But Lon Nol had eventually composed himself and, with a pile of new military equipment and newly recruited troops, had gone on the offensive. looking to relieve pressure on an important town in the north, Kompong Tom, by recapturing a large stretch of Highway 6. This had gone okay. Not a stunning success and not a stunning failure. It didn't quite achieve its goals, but had shown that the new army could do something. Chen La One, as it was called, despite not being much of one, was hailed a success. Before the enemy communist armies started eroding this massive presence on the highway by gradually pecking away at it and starting attacks at other parts of the country, drawing forces away. And this culminated in the clandestine attack on Pochentong Airport, which required the rest of the Chen La forces to retreat and go on the defensive once again around the city. And it was in the immediate aftermath of having to explain how everything was going to be okay to the parliament, even though 95% of the Cambodian Air Force had just exploded, well, that was when Lon Nol had a stroke. Now, my dear listener, all of those events, all of that in your first year on the job, that's a tough year. That's brutal. And I don't mean to be glib, but, you know, it was a tough first year for him. If we're looking at it as a profession, and like I said, if you're doing this performance review, that we can do with hindsight and history, and, you know, I kind of try and steer clear of counterfactuals in this show, but this is a big one where a choice could have been made, and it's not like there weren't people in suits in America and Cambodia doing exactly this kind of thing in March 1971. Like, this literally was their job to be looking at this and saying, how's this going? So if they're doing this review, how are they going to judge this moment? How do they say, okay, 1 year of Lon Nol, what are we doing here? Well, I don't like to judge people in the past too much because they just, you know, they were them and it was the past. Usually things can be explained with that kind of reasoning. But I do have to say, after that first year, with confidence going down, with everyone kind of getting an impression that this guy wasn't doing the best job before he had a stroke, I can't help but think that this would have been a very, very good opportunity to say, all right, maybe we get someone else in at the top right now. Lon Nol's wave, to the extent that it ever had any power to ride on, had come to, I think, a very natural end. And from this point on, was going to be going backwards. And that was immediately recognisable. And perhaps, just perhaps, with someone else at the helm, now, just as the Americans had signed off on a military and financial aid package of $180 million, which was a lot, so just with the timing and everything, it just seems like the perfect opportunity for Lon Nol himself to have stepped aside, or, you know, like, what are we talking about here? This is not exactly the political environment across the region where kicking out a head of state and getting in another one wasn't an extremely normalized activity. You know, it wouldn't be weird to have a change of head of government. Even another military guy, like you saw constantly in South Vietnam. So again, with the guy who is becoming very unpopular with the public and noticeably not very good at his job, you know, for the people that are interested in that kind of thing, and he's just had a stroke and he's left the country for 2 months, this is a very opportune time. So what happens? Well, it's not like there wasn't any goings on around this topic. There are politics afoot in Lon Nol's absence. In fact, after his leave of medical absence, two camps seem to form in this power vacuum, as well as rumours of a military coup, with military officials perhaps open to a change as well. On the one side, you had Sirik Mattak. He was rational, efficient, not particularly charismatic, and as we established in the episode around the coup, he didn't have the strongest ties to the military. He had needed Lon Nol's influence to set the coup in motion. He was the fiscal conservative, business interests kind of figure. I described him in the last episode as the brains as opposed to the emotion and brawn represented by his fellow coup conspirator, Lon Nol. He is said to have told a US ambassador that the general has to go in this period after the stroke. He is the main candidate to take his position. Sirik Mattak had become prime minister while Lon Nol was recovering. He was, by most measures, the natural fit to take this place in the long term. The Americans liked him. They felt he could be the guy. But in terms of the old political groupings that had existed in the pre-Sankum days, where all of Cambodian politics kind of got mushed into one big party, Sirik Mattak had represented the Republicans. While another crew of politicians were actually starting to line up behind another senior figure, not as prominent as Lon Nol, Sirik Mattak, but with a growing presence. His name was In Tam. He was popular, energetic, and an honest operator. Some of the old Democrats, those that hadn't had left-leaning positions, were his supporters. The same went for Son Yok Tan, who still commanded some popularity, even though he had been out of the country since the 1950s. You might recall he had brought his Khmer Serai forces back to serve Lon Nol's army around the same time as the coup, and was now active in recruiting Khmer Krom, the Khmers in South Vietnam, into the new Republican army. These three, Mattak, Tan, and In Tam, they kind of represent what would be... It's easy to say it would be a potential change in direction from where Lon Nol was heading. There was no getting away from the fact that the government was at war, but perhaps they might have added a pinch of pragmatism, perhaps helped stop the rising tide of corruption, maybe a change in style from the kind of racialized and religious-tinged rhetoric that Lon Nol was really leaning into as well. And you can imagine, with Lon Nol having been out of the picture since February, you know, people are looking around a little bit, having a few discussions, putting the feelers out, trying to organise themselves in case anything might happen, and to take advantage of any opportunities. But that was just one half of the picture. That was the normal politics side of the picture. The other side of the political organisation, if we could call it that, during Lon Nol's recuperation, was being handled by the Little Brother, a name used in fear more than affection for Lon Non. Lon Nol's younger brother wasn't interested in the more standard political groupings and parties. He was actively looking to destabilize these political factions so that Lon Nol's political dominance could be maintained. And naturally, this helps out his cause because he has been getting promoted right up the chain. He was ambitious and unscrupulous. He had also owed his graduation from military academy, where he had failed, and his army commission to his older brother. When the war began, he had gone from a police officer to an army officer and then a lieutenant colonel in charge of a brigade. The kind of guy that wants the uniform but doesn't actually want to be anywhere near any fighting as well. And this guy, this is just a really unfortunate guy to have in the story. As incompetent as he was greedy, as conniving as he was power hungry. As Wilfred Diak wrote in The Road to the Killing Fields, quote, Lon Non's reaction to the internal political rumblings that accompanied military defeat, continuing economic decline, and Lon Nol's stroke was twofold. Convince his brother, who said he was considering resigning, not to do so, and play potential rivals against each other to keep power in the family. He eyed American aid as a chance for further power and enrichment. According to one embassy observer, Lon Nol tried to insert himself into the US military assistance program by getting involved in the illicit arms trade. End quote. This guy, who some of you will remember was friends with Pol Pot all the way back in the early 1940s, and also spent time with him in Paris before going on quite different routes toward power, but this guy Lon Nol, He's the guy who is stealing things when the building is on fire, right? He's the guy making sure he gets his while the country literally collapses. And in this instance, to the extent that someone could have a personally significant influence on the story, it comes down to a punk like him that when his sick older brother is considering doing the best thing by retiring, little brother steps in and says, "Hey, no, what are you thinking? You are awesome. Keep it going." There's this awful little story about little brother in Henry Kam's book, where he also had been able to see the amassing of power and, you know, successive promotions to positions where he can influence things. And I think this was during the period in the first half of 1970. And there was a curfew for Vietnamese people from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. Anyway, Kam meets Lon Non one day, and he tells him that he had just put a Vietnamese businessman under arrest because he was receiving coded telegrams from abroad. He showed the New York Times journalist what he was talking about on the telegram in question, sort of pointing it out, and he showed him this bit after the sender's signature that there was a string of numbers, and Kam says, "Yeah, these numbers come with every telegram I get. They repeat all the numbers that appear in the text to make sure there are no errors." But Lon Non seemed unconvinced. Even when Kam showed him his own examples of telegrams he had been receiving, Lon Non said he would consider releasing this Vietnamese businessman, but Kam doubted that he ever did, particularly as this was at a time when the violence against innocent Vietnamese people at the hands of the government was really getting out of control. And that's just one tiny example of, you know, personal responsibility that Lon Non had here. But he's also implicated in reports, you know, linking military activity in Laos by Khmer troops to transporting heroin as the drug that had permeated much of the Vietnam War found a new battlefield in Cambodia. So Lon Nol's little brother, he's not a great guy in this story, but particularly at this crucial stage, you know, not even considering all of the other terrible things this guy does, but at this stage, the impact he has, where he's trying to block any kind of transition of power in a time when a transition of power would have been very ideal. But we'll see over the next couple of months and years, he's got some pretty serious eyes on getting himself into a successor role, so perhaps that was maybe his motivation. But the one big thing he does have on his side is that he, much like his older brother, has been able to forge close ties with some people in the military, which basically means he was assuring them that they would continue to get as much money as they wanted in return for their support of Lon Nol, which conveniently also meant more power for himself. Now this is why I think these months in February and March 1971 are the time where this action really had to be taken to get someone else into the leadership role and sideline Lon Nol and his little brother at this time, because I guess this, you know, this is where hindsight comes in handy, but these two are going to burrow in like ticks once Lon Nol does return to Phnom Penh in April. And it's important to say that, you know, I'll often say throughout this series how important the agency of the Cambodians in the story themselves is. You know, it's not just about, you know, what America did or what the Vietnamese did or what everyone else did. It's about the Cambodians themselves and the choices they make in this history, whether good or bad. But it's really important to factor that into the history. But in this instance, Sirik Mattak, for example, he's the logical guy to make the jump into the hot seat. He's got Americans on his side. He's even said, yeah, Lon Nol, the general, he's got to go. But he doesn't have, you know, the army on his side. But if the Americans had said, you know what, we're going to pull the same move we did in South Vietnam, we're going to do a ZM here, we don't want Lon Nol or his brother in charge, let's pull the plug on him, And if the generals in the army kick up a fuss, well, guess what? We're the ones with the money and the guns. So at the end of the day, they are going to go along with what we choose. You know, the US is the kingmaker here. But they refuse to intervene like one at this time. So what happened? Why didn't this pivotal moment go one way and instead stay the course it was on? Well, I think it comes back to this theme of a general malaise for the Americans. They were prioritizing their exit from Vietnam above all else. I mentioned Diem before, you know, back in like 1963, that was a fiasco, and they were just not interested in retreading that. I think, I'm not sure how connected this was either, but I was looking through the New York Times from these dates in February and March 1971, and while I'm going to the index and searching for Cambodian stories, I did see a lot of the front pages and noticed that this was the exact time that William Calley and Ernst Medina, among others, were being put on trial for the My Lai massacre.
The Army called its final witness today at the court-martial trial of Lieutenant William Calley. The witness, Jeffrey LaCrosse, was a platoon leader in the My Lai operation. He flatly contradicted Calley's testimony that Captain Ernest Medina had ordered the killing of civilians in My Lai. At their own request, the jurors will hear from three more witnesses, including Captain Medina.
And I realize it's been a while since we've touched on this story, but I won't go too deep into it now either, but keeps going over the next few years, but the public perception of the My Lai massacre in 1971 was incredible, because you had actually a lot of support for someone like William Calley. They even wrote a song about him, where the idea on, you know, let's say those supportive of the war's side, they look at the general My Lai story and they say, well, what are we punishing one of our boys for? Just for killing a bunch of communists? What are we doing? And then you have someone like Calley becoming a martyr for the extreme left as well, where it's like, yeah, this is just the outcome of an immoral war waged in immoral ways. Calley is a victim of the US war machine. It's wild stuff. He was found guilty of 22 counts of murder. But Nixon will actually intervene because of the public backlash and see that Calley goes to house arrest instead of prison. But again, we don't really need to get into that. It's just, this is all over the news in March 1971. Calley was found guilty on March 29th. So you can imagine everything leading up to that. So, you know, from February to March, the same time that Lon Nol was recovering from his stroke. And just, you know, imagine if you had the news alongside, you know, all of this going on that, oh, a US-backed coup sees Lon Nol ditched in favor of a new Cambodian leader, or, you know, something like that, particularly with Congress being so completely opposed to a new Vietnam happening. And that just would have, from an optics point of view, that would have looked like an exact play-by-play replica of the crisis facing South Vietnam in 1963. That's what Cambodia looked like. And with this My Lai trial going on, you have this horrifying vision of what is seemingly the inevitable outcome of that. Even from a military standpoint, it is, if nothing else, a deeply shameful episode. And that's not all. I'll only just touch on it now. It was a few months after this that this actually came out, so it doesn't really pertain to the whole Lon Nol story. But in June and July, the so-called Pentagon Papers will be leaked, causing another storm of controversy as Americans learned how successive administrations had secretly expanded and misrepresented the war in Vietnam. Strangely, this actually didn't have much effect on Nixon himself, because it was all about the previous administrations, and he had kind of ran on like a, yeah, I'm getting us out of that mess. But he will form an obsession with plugging leaks, and that is going to get the ball rolling toward Watergate, which, again, this is another time. The point being is that this is a very bad time, optics-wise, to be doing anything that looked like it was going to be repeating the decisions which had brought the US to this point in Indochina. Henry Kam summarizes this from the Cambodian point of view. He simply says that this was a time where Cambodia had jumped headlong onto the American bandwagon at a time when the bandwagon's gear had shifted into reverse. Washington was disengaging from Indochina and no longer cared how its newest proxy war was going to be run as long as it didn't interfere with the withdrawal from Vietnam. And that is that. That is why, even though US Ambassador Emery Swank, known as this kind of suave and accomplished diplomat, who wasn't quite, you know, burying his head in the sand to the extent that others were, and later he will comment openly about what his feelings were during this time, but he was openly preferring Sirik Mattak in 1971, in the wake of Lon Nol's stroke. But they just failed to really do anything about that. And even though Mattak was acting prime minister while Lon Nol was in Hawaii, he was kind of left out in the cold. He was unprotected against what Lon Nol was getting up to, who was, you know, amassing his personal power base and preventing change from occurring. And this leaves the door open for Lon Nol's return in April. But he's been having an interesting time in Hawaii.
It may be apparent to him the reaction of the individual standing in front of him as he takes this action. But what is not apparent to him is how far-reaching the effect of what he has done may have through a wide spectrum of individuals who either hear about this or have seen the results of some action that he takes. Now, in the business of propagation of sea power...
Folks, you might remember this character I introduced a few episodes back. This is Admiral John McCain Jr., not the one that was a prisoner of war in Vietnam and went on to be a senator. That's the late John McCain III. This is the John McCain that was the commander-in-chief of the Pacific Command. And he's, you know, this admiral, he's like a caricature. I just wanted to get this back in your memory with him sort of setting the tone and droning a little bit, and he always had a cigar in hand and the Navy uniform, and if he saw a map of the world, in his mind, China was red and had claws coming over the lands and seas on the end of big growing arrows. He's also in Hawaii. That's, you know, that's where he's at. He's being chief of the Pacific Command. And remember, this was the guy that was pretty instrumental in convincing Nixon that the Cambodian incursion was the right move when Nixon was just in the neighborhood picking up the guys who had crash-landed from Apollo 13. So you know that he's going to hit it off with Lon Nol. They had already met in October the previous year. McCain had come to Phnom Penh for a two-day visit. They discussed the military situation, and McCain had been encouraged by his visit. In late 1971, Lon Nol will even give McCain an elephant, which, you know, the newspapers make out this is a slightly inconvenient gift to receive. It had to go back to a zoo in LA, who they kind of put their hands up and said we could handle this because elephants aren't well suited to just hanging around Honolulu. But still, it shows you that the two guys had become buddies, and I think a lot of that came from when Lon Nol was recovering in Hawaii at the start of 1971. And they would have had a long time to get to know each other. He was just there. They were both in their early 60s at this point. They were both very much believers in their respective religions, although Lon Nol had very Cambodian beliefs. But communists, to both men, were the opposite of that. They were unbelievers. They openly wanted to tear down religion. And McCain, I mean, you heard him speak just before. You could imagine him having a very inspiring kind of chat with you, couldn't you? That guy tells you about leadership, and you're like, yes, yes, sir. Even if it might be kind of nonsense, and if it was just sort of going on, you'd find yourself leaving that room being like, yeah, that guy really said something with authority. And it's perhaps a mix of, you know, the beautiful locale, the company he was keeping, the fresh air, that we see Lon Nol's spirits rising. Actually, it's in Wilfred Dyack's book that he includes this fun little story about one aspect of Lon Nol's Hawaiian holiday, recovery times, when the general is watching television on Oahu one day, which in and of itself is kind of humorous thing to imagine, just Lon Nol watching regular daytime telly, probably with his feet up, wearing socks and sandals, that kind of thing. Anyway, suddenly an advert for this vitamin supplement comes on, and it might have been this one, which I think even in the 70s had its own backlash for being sexist, but here's a little part of it.
My wife is incredible. She took care of the baby all day, cooked a great dinner, and even went to a school meeting. And look at her. She's in better shape than any of her friends. Of course, she takes care of herself. Gets her rest, does sit-ups, watches her diet, and to make sure she gets enough iron and vitamins, she takes Geritol every morning. Makes me take it, too.
More than twice the iron of ordinary supplements, plus 7 vitamins. Take care of yourself. Take Geritol.
My wife. I think I'll keep her.
Geritol. What a product, right? Anyway, but as Dyack says, quote, he excitedly reacted to an advertisement for Geritol. Nol shared the typical Asian male's concern with virility, and having been chided by his wife for being less sexually active in his mid-50s, saw the high-potency product as just what he needed. I want Geritol, he told his American benefactors, end quote. And I can imagine him getting on the phone to whoever his handler was. Get me Geritol. But, you know, it's not just in Hawaii, but, you know, he makes sure that this becomes a steady stream. You know, he gets this product through the American embassy, and he even goes on to credit this multivitamin for the birth of his 4th child in the next few years. Anyway, you can imagine Lon Nol getting pretty fired up hearing some of McCain's long, rambling talks about the spread of communism, you know, with the maps and the Chinese arrows and stuff. And he's getting caught up in the duty and leadership of his position. He's also full of vitamins with the Geritol. And Lon Nol's head was already, you know, we've talked about his willingness to indulge in these grand racial and religious doctrines of faith. And I think this really reinforced his sense of needing to act in accordance with that. Lon Nol starts telling McCain that he wants to hold a Buddhist conference in Phnom Penh with delegates from Thailand, Laos, and Burma to discuss the communist menace. With a renewed vigor, he sends a telegram to Sirikmatak back in Phnom Penh and says to him, quote, make every possible effort to increase the struggle of the Buddhist line against the Tamil line, and to this end, convene a conference in Phnom Penh, end quote. And remember, Tamil means unbelievers. And so Sirikmatak sees this, and probably with some more important work to do, almost like when you get an inebriated text message from a friend who might be in a different time zone and you're just not in the same zone of enthusiasm, Sirikmatak defers this request to a committee and replies with, you know, wishing Lon Nol a speedy recovery. The equivalent of being like, yes, love you too, mate, we should go fishing again one day. And he just carries on with his day. But Lon Nol was, you know, he's back up. 2 weeks later, he proposed to McCain that the US should dam the Mekong north of Stung Treng. So the river, the Mekong River, northeast of Phnom Penh, where the river heads up towards Laos, he says the US should dam the river to stop the North Vietnamese from being able to use it, and suggested that US troops could guard the dam, and this would internationalize the war if the Vietnamese attacked them. Now, we're talking about the Mekong River. Again, you can't just be shutting bits of it off. This was bordering on a childlike idea, and McCain, the admiral, again with the kind of kindness you might treat a friend who has had a few too many, he passed this wild idea onto his superiors without any extra comments. A kind of less said about that the better, but he also closed his message by remarking cheerfully, "Lon Nol's looking good." And it wasn't long after that, on the 12th of April, that Lon Nol made his surprise return to Phnom Penh. After nearly 2 months of medical treatment, he made his way off a US Navy plane, looking healthy-ish, as he still needed a wheelchair at times as he disembarked, and then a cane as he walked. He was kissed on both cheeks by the acting premier, Sirik Mattak, and Lon Nol told him, "We still have some work to do." And he was driven away to his office at the Ministry of Defense to take control of a 20th century war. He's had months of Hawaiian pep talks from the admiral. He has his Geritol. It was business time for Lon Nol. Chandler says that one of the first things he said to the public was an announcement over Phnom Penh radio reminding the listeners that Buddhism would last 5,000 years and that the Tamil are not invulnerable. And if you're wondering about the 5,000-year aspect of that announcement, I can only presume, because Chandler doesn't actually qualify the statement, but I'm sort of putting two and two together here. But from what I do know about Buddhism, in the Theravada tradition, the cosmology, their view of the universe, holds that the teachings of the Gautama Buddha, the one that lived around 500 BCE, his teachings are going to last for about 5,000 years. Then they will disappear. Buddhism itself will disappear. And then the next Buddha, Maitreya, will appear and reintroduce the Dharma, the truth of reality, and spread the Buddha's teachings once again. But in this instance, I think that Lon Nol's invoking this 5,000-year time span to basically say, hey, we're not done yet. We've still got 2,500 years to go. We're not going to be defeated right now. The unbelievers will be forced back. So this is, I mean, it's pretty dramatic. It's a dramatic message, but it certainly speaks to his view of what's going on and what he is trying to frame things like. And as well as what he says to Sirik Mattak, very much a kind of, let's get back to business, I'm back kind of demeanor. Which in and of itself is a surprise, right? There had been hope that the partially paralyzed Prime Minister would have assumed a ceremonial role from this point. In fact, Ambassador Swank believed Lon Nol was simply too sick to be the Prime Minister anymore. He said he was obviously not well enough to face the enormous mental and emotional demands. And what makes the timeline of this part of the story just a tad confusing is that when Lon Nol did return in April, at the end of the month, he briefly, symbolically resigned and said that his health was an issue. This provoked a 2-week political crisis. As you can imagine, everyone was figuring out what to do. Oh, is this our chance? I don't know. And then once the resignation was accepted in the National Assembly, the head of state, Cheng Heng, immediately asked Lon Nol to form a new government. So most of the sources I have here are a little vague on what all of this was really meant to achieve, but if it was another possibility of a real hand-off of power, well, it wasn't taken, and if it was just theatrics, it reintroduced Lon Nol as the guy. He was going to be the guy leading the country forward, regardless of the political intrigue that had surrounded the last couple of months. He had been reaffirmed as the ruler of the Khmer Republic. Whatever had happened when the dust settled, Lon Nol had also been bestowed the rank of Field Marshal. Field Marshal Lon Nol. I realized at some point writing these Chen La episodes that these are also just the Lon Nol episodes, and we've been circling around a few of his personality traits and actions that define aspects of the, well, it's in the name, isn't it, the so-called Lon Nol regime, that the short-lived Khmer Republic will often be called. And I've touched on this before, the racial and religious energy he brought to his time in power, so it's worth exploring that in a little bit more depth before we move on, because it is this thing that comes up a lot. And one of the reasons it's so important is because in this post-stroke period, Lon Nol, literally on doctor's orders, is limited to 1 hour per day of official business. And he was practically allergic to technology. He didn't read newspapers, didn't listen to the radio or watch television, and he didn't use the telephone. Henry Kam says that ministers and generals rarely visited Lon Nol's villa, but Buddhist monks had free access and would often turn up without appointments. It was this strange process where he simultaneously became increasingly concerned with accumulating more power and sidelining political rivals like Sirik Mattak and Im Tham and Son Yoktan, while also becoming more detached from actually governing the country. The monks and mystics he was in regular contact with interpreted the war in mystical and apocalyptic terms, which he was already fond of prior to his stroke, and I think this idea that they preach, where the Khmer people are divinely chosen defenders of Theravada Buddhism, well, Lon Nol really latches onto this. He creates his own kind of grand theory of things, which he called Khmer Mon civilization. Now, what's that? So anthropologists and linguists use a phrase Mon Khmer to refer to a branch of the Austroasiatic language family. So essentially saying that there is a common language and ethnic group from thousands of years ago, and this is shared with some of the ethnicities that live in Southeast Asia, in modern-day Myanmar and Cambodia in this instance. I'm not sure even if people would still use the phrase Mon Khmer today. It might have kind of gone out of style, but it is a little bit like, if it were a Western context, kind of referring back to, say, a Nordic or Celtic identity and invoking the kind of spirit and mysticism that can come along with that. So Lon Nol took that Mon Khmer phrase, which is how it was said, I believe, because the Mon culture preceded the Khmer one, but he flips that to Khmer Mon civilization, and, you know, that's a bit of a tell as to what he was doing here, which was elevating the Khmer amongst this broader background of the peoples of mainland Southeast Asia, and as the pinnacle of Buddhist civilization. He even published a kind of manifesto espousing this theory, which he called Neo-Khmerism. This rather slim pamphlet, as Elizabeth Becker describes it, was Lon Nol's interpretation of Cambodian history, where the ancient Khmer lived in a utopia. Quote, "At the peak of its splendour, our country earned the surname of Chen La the Rich, and the people lived an easy, comfortable life." Chen La being the pre-Angkorian kingdom, you'll recall, but as is always entwined with the realities of the historical record, as is with the heavy editorialising of Cambodian nationalism, while the Khmer race was glorified, its neighbours were vilified as aggressors, beginning with the Siamese invasion in the 14th century, so the idyllic past was destroyed, and then this was further emphasised by the crises of the 17th and 18th centuries, where the Annamites, as he called the Vietnamese, and the Siamese continued to attack the Cambodian people. He then goes on to say, quote, "Our people, having known glory and power, entered into a period of difficulty, because at that moment, European colonialism appeared on the horizon," end quote. And then he blames, you know, the problems of Indochina on the colonial partition. He puts on the English and French, the whites, as he says. Now, what Lon Nol has done there in his retreading, his recapitulation of Cambodian history and his sort of blaming of other peoples and his victimization of his own, I mean, this isn't a Cambodian-only phenomenon. I think you basically see the same attempt played out all across the world at different times, particularly in the 20th century, but even today, usually when things get a little tough economically or otherwise, you have a certain, you know, you have a certain subset of people pulling out the history books and reimagining a time when everything was supposedly perfect. And this will often go hand in hand, usually with the idea that it was also somehow racially pure or a time of a religious golden age. And that's, you know, the fault of foreigners or invaders or whoever it may be to have somehow corrupted this. It's a point I was trying to make in the last episode too, about us not being overly shocked that there were these religious emblems and sort of blessed amulets and things like that being brought into the war zone by the Khmer soldiers, this thing that often gets really focused on in this history. But, you know, it's not that abnormal, I think, relatively speaking. And I think Lon Nol's manifesto here isn't hugely different from many other ethno-nationalistic theories that get tossed around in many different countries at many different times. And it is the same way that he's going after the Vietnamese in this pamphlet as well, where he says that the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong are the modern children of the Annamites that took Cambodian territory. They are hereditary enemies, and they've come to, quote, systematically destroy our socioeconomic structure and our civilization, to make our people subservient, to change our way of life, to modify our way of thinking, and to abolish our religious beliefs, end quote. Again, these are pretty common talking points, aren't they? They sound quite familiar. But what is also worth mentioning here is, you know, I'm trying to normalize Lon Nol's grand racial civilizational theory here, but I should also say, it's not like everyone else was nodding along going, yeah, I reckon you might be right. I mean, some people were, some people weren't. It was just this one aspect of his leadership. But it does become more and more central. So his deepening belief in this and his, you know, prophetic visions, these are frustrating some Cambodian officials and certainly American diplomats who, with good reason, are wanting him to focus on present-day governance and military realities. And again, remember, his doctors have said, don't work too hard, just an hour a day. And it's like, I know I went pretty hard on Sihanouk at points, even though I do have a soft spot for the guy, but he kind of had to be critical of all the jazz and movies he was doing in the late 60s when things were getting pretty bad. And in the case of Lon Nol, I'm not sure whether this is necessarily worse than directing movies and playing jazz, but it's not great. And it's just, it's another thing you can point to when you have this opportunity that had arisen when the guy has a stroke, and you just wish that he'd been completely sidelined at that point, out of the picture, but the opposite ends up happening. One of the chief spiritual advisors brought into the fold by Lon Nol was this guy from the countryside named Mam Prumoni, the great intellectual of pure glory. He would give followers of his, you know, protective cloth. He was considered a visionary by Lon Nol, and maybe even a reincarnation of Jayavarman VII, who claimed to hail from all of the mountains of Cambodia. A close Lon Nol supporter, Madame No Nio, she said that this monk was the most important man for General Lon Nol, the most important of the 10 monks that he consults with regularly. She said that on just one occasion, a Monday, Lon Nol had spoke with this guy in private for 4 hours. And according to the same woman, soldiers blessed by him would be afforded protections, like if they stepped on a landmine, it either wouldn't explode, or if it did, they would only be left with a few black marks. She was fully invested in this monk's supposed powers, which indicates this kind of, I guess, how Lon Nol and his little brother had managed to wrangle enough support to form a kind of cloister around him. Basically a bunch of yes men and women to probably counter what those who wanted change were recommending, whenever they got a chance to actually speak to him, that is. In July, a few months after Lon Nol had come back from Hawaii, US Ambassador Swank met with him for 2 hours. Swank said the marshal was mentally alert. They talked about continuing US aid, and when the conversation turned to domestic matters, Lon Nol became animated. According to Swank, Lon Nol spoke of the historic superiority of the Khmer people to their western and eastern neighbours. Now, that gives you a sense of the man. You know how sometimes when you really get to know someone, you discover they've got some fringe theories. Usually they don't lead with those in work meetings, for instance. But here, Lon Nol was straight-faced, laying out his grand Khmer Mon theory to the US ambassador, right alongside the usual facts and figures about military and financial aid. He even recounted an old Khmer legend used to explain a period of national decline centuries earlier. A sacred buffalo containing the creative soul of the Khmer nation had been stolen by the Thai. Lon Nol said the task now was to restore that national soul. This is from Chandler's Tragedy of Cambodian History, and yes, that title, he certainly knew how to pick a good title. Chandler, who interviewed Swank in 1987, quotes him as saying, "He had never encountered a situation so fraught with ambiguity in his career, and that it was often difficult to disguise the conviction that the Cambodians were doomed." And here's where we hit the real problem, because in theory, and I want to stress that, in theory, you could say that Nixon's intervention after the coup made a certain kind of sense. The Vietnamese communists taking over Cambodia would have been a disaster for US interests. So stopping that wasn't, on the surface, indefensible. Even if you believe the intervention was wrong, and I can agree with you there, I'd still say it was a tough decision, a catch-22, as Wilfred Diak called it. But in theory, once you've made that move, you now have to prop up the new Lon Nol regime. You're not going to send US troops, you can't do that, but you can flood the place with cash, guns, and military equipment, thinking that should hold things together long enough for us to leave Indochina. That's the Nixon doctrine in a nutshell. The problem was that this aid was going into a corrupt military system, a system where you could literally buy and sell the stripes on your uniform, where patronage networks handed out jobs because of family connections. Not long ago, under Sihanouk, you had a naval commander starring in his movies. Now you had Lon Nol's little brother, Lon Non, riding promotion after promotion until he was in charge of over 10,000 elite troops. That's the part of society that the Americans had just turned the money tap on for. They weren't putting resources into the economy in ways that might lift the whole country, just into the army, because that's all Washington cared about. An army that could keep the Viet Cong and the NVA quiet long enough for the US to leave. It was, in many ways, the same mistake they'd made in South Vietnam, letting corruption spiral out of control, focusing only on the fighting, and losing the battle for public perception. And when that happens, regardless of how brutal the communists might in fact be, people will look at the nepotism and graft around them and concede, well, the communists are doing better on that front. And that's a huge propaganda failure, because it touches everyone's daily life in a way they can see and feel. And everyone knows this one always gets mentioned, but the most glaring example of this, of the corruption, as it was emerging in the Khmer Republic, in the army, it was the so-called ghost soldiers, the phantom soldiers, where officers in the army would inflate their troop numbers, putting phantom soldiers on the payroll and pocketing the difference. Many of them even sold military equipment, guns, and ammunition straight to the communists. In 1971, American diplomats had become suspicious of the official figures of the army and demanded a headcount. And instead of the 200,000 strong armed forces that were being boasted, well, it turned out it was closer to 150,000, if we could trust that number. But that's, you know, a quarter of the army just not being real. That's not good. That is some writing on the wall stuff. In fact, Cambodian ministers would even begin to admit that corruption in the new republic was worse than it had been when it contributed to the fall of Sihanouk. And if that was a kind of sinking feeling, I mean, you can imagine that scene in the movie where the intrepid researcher or journalist is looking through all the files and numbers and documents and they put it all together. And they have that moment of realization, that oh no moment. And I think there's a collective sense of that that some people are starting to discover. And I think that is what Ambassador Swank was, you know, summing up very well when he said it was hard to disguise his conviction that the Cambodians were doomed. Okay, I want to turn our attention away from Lon Nol for the moment and toward the general landscape of the war in the first half of 1971. So one thing that kind of goes under the radar because of the attack on the airport and the subsequent stroke and political stuff is what we left off that last Chen La episode on, where there is another similarly large push to reopen another stretch of highway, but instead of Highway 6 to Kampong Tom and Siem Reap, this is Highway 4 heading west toward the Gulf of Thailand and the port at Kampong Som, which had had its name changed from Sihanoukville, of course. The Cambodian government troops weren't making much progress and ended up turning to the Americans and South Vietnamese for help. On January 13th, a US air-supported two-pronged Khmer South Vietnamese operation kicked off. I'll spare you the topography and all of that like the last time, but the plan was essentially a pincer movement between highways 3 and 4 along the Elephant Mountain Range. That's toward the coast west, southwest of Phnom Penh. The same hills that have the Bacor Mountain Resort on the southern end, and on the northern side of that terrain is a long stretch called the Pik Nil Pass, and that's where the two forces planned to meet. The hills were defended by around three battalions, so between 1,000 and 3,000 North Vietnamese soldiers, plus perhaps 500 to 1,000 Khmer Rouge troops. Fighting in those tree-covered mountains meant ambushes, digging in, and constant calls for air support. By January 22nd, the Khmer troops managed to break through the communist defences, with the help of Khmer Krom units, those specially trained units from South Vietnam that had been trained by the US to fight in that war and were now fighting in Cambodia. They made a decisive push and linked up with the South Vietnamese. It was a modest victory, but still very welcome. It was also a textbook example of how the US was trying to participate in this war from behind a blanket, except the blanket never quite covered everything. Particularly with air power, it's hard not to notice the massive craters left by US B-52s or the napalm dropped by F-4 Phantom jets on communist positions facing Cambodian troops. And there was a kind of cognitive dissonance here. Publicly, the line was, no more US troops will fight in Cambodia, but nobody had said anything about fighting in the air. In March, the US Defense Secretary made it official, designating the total land area of Cambodia, including inland waters and adjacent sea areas, as a hostile fire area, effective January 1st, 1971. His stated reason was that these actions were in direct support of military operations in the Vietnamese combat zone. That year, 10% of all bombs dropped in the entire theatre of war fell on Cambodia. In just the first 6 months of 1971, there were about 1,000 fixed-wing gunship sorties, and that could mean, you know, 10 planes flying 100 missions each, or 100 planes flying 10 missions each. This wasn't just carpet bombing either, it was all types of air support, but you can see the pattern starting here. In the years that followed, it would become the main lever that the US kept pulling for this war. And remember the context. After Pochentong Airport was hit by Viet Cong commandos in January, there was naturally a heavier reliance on US air power for both Cambodian and South Vietnamese operations. And while we haven't reached the level of carpet bombing that will be unleashed in the next 2 years of the war, even in 1971, we can see the terrible effects of these kinds of weapons. One incident, which has all of the same features as the infamous bombing of Nick Long in 1973, took place in Angkor Boray. That's a town near the South Vietnamese border, and in fact a former capital from the pre-Angkorian Chen La period, home to stone temples dating back to the 6th century. It was struck by a three-plane cell of B-52 Stratofortresses, flying in formation, spaced and timed to maximise the effect of a carpet bombing run. These bombers often flew at about the same height as a passenger jet cruising over the ocean, so if you've looked out the window mid-flight, that's the kind of altitude we're talking about. From that height, with precise timing, they could drop a payload capable of devastating more than half a square mile, just under 2 square kilometres. For comparison, that's about half of Central Park in Manhattan, completely flattened in one go. In this case, the B-52 raid was followed by fire from Khmer T-28 fighter planes. The details are scarce, Dieck's book is one of the only sources, but He writes that the attack left more than 100 civilians dead, many of them buried under their houses. He also explains how incidents like this could happen. We tend to imagine American carpet bombing as this kind of mowing the lawn, indiscriminate and automatic sort of action, but it wasn't exactly that. Dyack points to another way that these strikes were going astray. Quote, "Inadequate communications accompanied the less than ideal coordination of airstrikes involving military partners with different languages, methods, and outlooks. For example, the Khmer High Command might request a raid on an enemy training camp. The latter, it was discovered too late, was simply the site of a political indoctrination session by communist cadres, who left their peasant audience immediately after giving their spiel." End quote. The implication being that while most American airmen followed strict rules of engagement to protect non-combatants, their allied counterparts were less scrupulous. And it's just an aspect of the American bombing that I think kind of goes underrepresented, where, you know, this is a collaborative effort. You have Khmer soldiers on the ground, Khmer commanders, who are saying, hey, go to this place and bomb this area because the enemy is there. But as Dyack is pointing out there, poor communication and differences in what really was a target or not, as well as what counted as restraint, meant that something could become a target that really shouldn't have. And in that instance, with this communist meeting over and the village being bombed, the logical thing that would happen next, well, of course, the communists come back and find new recruits after that senseless killing. Dyack goes on to detail how the lines were blurred further in this war zone where communist troops weaved in and out of civilian areas. Quote, "Even observing the rules of engagement left open such questions as how aviators were to respond to the deliberate communist placement of military units in villages and the use of Khmer porters in battle zones. The movement of peasants, often displaced by the fighting, further aggravated the problem. Finally, the devastating weapons of modern warfare are much less precise than their introducers would like to believe. The Cambodian government, which believed civilian casualties during the first year of the war to be 500 dead and 1,000 hurt, said that 20% of the nation's combat damage was owing to air bombardment. A US congressional report placed casualties in the thousands during the first month alone, blaming most on tactical airstrikes." End quote. And I want to keep building this theme of the bombing, as we have done for a few episodes now, but I also want to introduce the idea, and it comes back to this idea of how the war was being fought and how it had been fought in South Vietnam and in Laos. Like, the Cambodians are being equipped with ammunition, weapons, and the ability to call in airstrikes. And as one US embassy official remarked, they were being kind of strapped into a technological straitjacket. It's just not what was required for this war. Just like a lot of the technological warfare brought to South Vietnam was inappropriate. You know, it's like giving a Ferrari to a 17-year-old who just wants to be able to take his friends to school. You aren't really going to help get to the solution to the problems with that technology. And while this American military aid is pouring in, they had not set up a system for it to be properly distributed, nor had they cared to make sure it was being distributed properly. Dyack points out that most of the modern M16 rifles coming into the country were not going to the troops fighting the war, but to the soldiers protecting the government in Phnom Penh. But in this period, we're speaking about sort of the first 6 months of 1971, aside from the operations on Route 4 out to the Gulf of Thailand and a few clashes around the capital to the northeast, most of the fighting that occurred in Cambodia was still Vietnamese fighting Vietnamese. Which is just another reminder that, you know, the so-called Cambodian Civil War, at least the first couple of years of it, really was just a new front in the Vietnam War opened up for the North and South to fight in. So the question is, in the months after Lon Nol returns to the country, so mid-1971, how bad was it? I think the impression I'm trying to give here is certainly gloomy. I know it's a little bit all over the shop, and I think overall, saying it wasn't looking good was a fair assessment, although I do think the Cambodians themselves weren't quite as pessimistic, even those that thought Lon Nol's stroke was a kind of bad omen or could see the corruption. I think, to an extent, this was perhaps like the proverbial frog in the boiling pot, right? And the Cambodian people had been in that pot long before Lon Nol was in power. But there were signs that this was only going one way. For instance, rice. You know how much I've talked about rice on this podcast. You know it is the backbone of the Cambodian economy. But even just as a crop, Cambodia has always been exporting it. But they've always had enough to, you know, feed themselves as well. They could export almost 200,000 tons a year with enough left over for the Cambodian people. But over the stretch of 1971, increasingly the government will become an importer of rice, covering the gap in what they've lost to the black market and to enemy actions in the countryside, which have basically taken away their ability to count on this of, you know, their most important export. They're having to purchase 100,000 tons of the staple by the end of the year. The New York Times also reported on a money crisis in late June. Inflation was rising, the riel was collapsing, and sectors of the economy fell into chaos. But I think some of this would be expected. This was, after all, a country at war. Economic conditions can be predictably unpredictable, and they did have the US just propping up everything anyway. Things were not fatal. It wasn't all over. Particularly if we, you know, we accept the reality that this was a country at war, what is the most important thing in that scenario? Military power. And the Lon Nol regime is good on that front. Even with the phantom soldiers, they still have a greater numerical advantage to the North Vietnamese and Khmer Rouge and Viet Cong troops in the country, which is around 85,000, with three quarters of that being Vietnamese troops at this time. And of course, Lon Nol's army, although there were negatives attached, still could count on the support of the Americans in terms of air power and the South Vietnamese in terms of, you know, on-the-ground forces. So this plays out in one of the battles just east of Phnom Penh in May and June 1971, where by the end of that month, a 12,000-strong Cambodian offensive, assisted by massive US air power, as well as the start of the rainy season, gradually clears out a lowland area 15 miles east of Phnom Penh in Prey Vang province. This was celebrated with a victory east of the Mekong parade in Phnom Penh, where captured arms were put on display. It was another minor win for Lon Nol, but as Wilfred Dyack describes, well, even these little victories were often made pointless because the tactic the Cambodians were using was a kind of advance, then pull back. So, yeah, they cleared this area out of communists, but then they could just re-infiltrate once the government forces had departed. So then you have to re-clear the zone again. And it basically sounds just like the early years of the Vietnam War in the South, right? A kind of depressing restaging of the same play, with many of the lessons needing to be relearned, and soon this would play out in the Khmer Republic's politics as well. Because in the middle of 1971, Phnom Penh politics were already tense. July and August saw cabinet reshuffles and shifts in senior titles. In Tham, the popular Minister of the Interior and First Deputy Prime Minister, was abruptly dismissed. His removal had less to do with policy and more with power. In Tham's popularity and independence made him a potential rival to Lon Nol, and probably to Sirik Mattak as well, who also had no desire to see another strong figure rise in the government. Son Yoc-Tan, the veteran nationalist leader, was brought closer into the orbit of power, but even his presence couldn't disguise the fact that the Khmer Republic's democratic facade was crumbling. The breaking point came in October. The five-year mandate of the National Assembly was about to expire, meaning the terms of its legislators were legally coming to an end. Under normal circumstances, a general election would have followed, but with much of the countryside in enemy hands and an important phase of the war underway, this was never really considered. For Lon Nol and Sirik Mattak, the Assembly had become an obstacle, fractious, uncooperative, and in their eyes, irrelevant in wartime. So what does this mean? Well, the Assembly, elected under Sihanouk's old system, was one of the last functioning symbols of representative government in Cambodia. Removing its legislative power would clear the way for Lon Nol to govern without parliamentary interference. On October 16th, Lon Nol's acting government issued a decree stripping the National Assembly and Senate of their lawmaking powers. The two-house parliament was reclassified as a constituent assembly, a body whose sole role was to draft a new constitution. This was presented as a compromise between competing factions, backing different would-be leaders, but in practice, it allowed Lon Nol to form a new government without the bother of elections. 4 days later, on October 20th, Lon Nol announced over a nationwide radio broadcast that he had assembled a government designed to halt what he called the nation's drift toward anarchy. Certain groups, clans, and associations, he claimed, were dividing the country and sowing confusion. Cambodia, he warned, was headed toward defeat. To combat this anarchy, the country had to end what he described as the sterile game of outmoded liberal democracy. A luxury, he argued, that only played into enemy hands. His government, he declared, has chosen the path to victory. So, what did this mean in practice? Well, the decree concentrated power in the executive and significantly curtailed the rights of the assembly. A free press and habeas corpus, the legal protection against arbitrary detention, were just completely eroded. While Cambodia was still officially the Khmer Republic, Lon Nol had now established the legal framework to rule by decree, effectively creating a military-backed dictatorship under wartime conditions. And this is why it makes sense to use the phrase Lon Nol regime to describe the Khmer Republic. And these moves came about right in the middle of what was supposed to be his triumphant military victory that heralded his return to power. Chen La II. I'm sure some of you out there are into your movies. Not necessarily cinephiles, but, you know, my dear listener, I bet you know a thing or two, can talk the talk. And when I was a kid, I used to think that every movie I loved should have a sequel. If a movie was great, why wouldn't you make more of it? I think this is one of the things you grow out of a little bit, particularly once you see how short the list of actually very good sequels there are. Even when a sequel is good, it's rarely better than the first one. And that's just down to the nature of it not being original anymore. Besides, many sequels will also literally just do the same plot again. But they might try and do it on a bigger scale. Higher stakes, more explosions, more ambition. And quite often resulting in a big failure. Sometimes a sequel can fail so hard that it ruins the director's career and the whole franchise can turn like sour milk. Which brings us to Lon Nol's Operation Chen La II, which had quite a bit more riding on it than a box office return. Planning for Chen La II was underway soon after Lon Nol, puffed up on vitamins and pep talks from John McCain, and maybe some brain damage from his stroke, got back from Hawaii. You'll recall from the last Chen La episode how, in the aftermath of all the chaos and the US intervention midway through 1970, Lon Nol and his military strategists had divided the map of Cambodia basically in half, along a diagonal line which stretched from Thailand to South Vietnam, and above that line, well, they'd basically given that up to the communists. Below that line, including Phnom Penh, they had to consolidate their control, and then ideally start trying to regain territory north of the so-called Lon Nol line. Route 6, the highway that goes north then northwest from Phnom Penh up to Kompong Tom and then up to Siem Reap, that had been the focus of Chen La 1. to lift the siege on that important town, reopen this strategically and economically significant bit of territory along the highway, with all this countryside rich in rice, fish and rubber, all the while showing that the new Republican army under Lon Nol could get things done. Chen La Tu was exactly the same objectives. And just like the original, it also suited American objectives of alleviating communist pressure on their Vietnamization of the combat operations in South Vietnam. And it was all about this triangle of territory north of Phnom Penh, connected by Route 6, 7, and 21. Check the website link in the description for a map and some helpful diagrams. But very importantly, if you look at this diagram, the map here, you'll see these really large areas that are the Cham Ca Lu and Cham Ca An Dong rubber plantations. Those are within the area of the triangle that the highways make. Keep those in mind. And again, keep in mind that the main column of troops that will go up Route 6, and I mean that like a column, think of a convoy of trucks going up a road, but replace lots of the trucks with other kinds of military vehicles and more than 15,000 soldiers, and you've also got these diversionary sort of forces going up Route 21 and 71 and also taking a river route to Kompong Tom, just like Chen La One. During the planning for this within the army staff, no one was really disputing the fact that the Chen La Two objectives were good objectives, or that they weren't in accordance with the Lon Nol line strategy. But a few heads were being scratched with a bit of umming and ahhing when it came to exactly how the government troops were going to deal with the at least two or three North Vietnamese divisions in the area, as well as an undetermined number of Khmer Rouge units. And you'd think, you know, with some of the lessons learned from the previous summer's offensive, you know, stringing out your troops in this long column where they are in unfriendly territory with both of their flanks exposed, that some people, you know, they thought to point out that this was a risky strategy. Some within the military staff, echoing suggestions out of the US Embassy, suggested that perhaps efforts should be made to first draw out and destroy the North Vietnamese battalions that would be to the east of Route 6 before travelling up that highway. They also pointed out that the units picked to carry out the operation, having borne the brunt of the fighting for months on end, were understrength and overworked. Lon Nol, perhaps with just a touch of what he presumed to be divine intervention on his side, was convinced that US air power would destroy the enemy, and disregarded any doubts of success. He carried on. On August 20th, Lon Nol's troops began moving up Highway 6, and the more than 16,000 strong column headed out, keeping on going north from Tang Kauk, where the first Chen La operation had kind of stalled. But this time, this massive number of troops and armoured and transport vehicles and everything else, they only met minor resistance. You'll recall last time it was very stop-start, and there was a lot of fighting at every sort of mile they tried to conquer. But the sequel? No, they're breezing up Route 6. 4 days after they had set out, they arrived at Rum Long. 3 days later, Barai. More than three quarters of the way up this stretch of Route 6 that had proved so hard to traverse last time. Now at this town, at Barai, as Wilfred Diak reports, the government troops were received by peasants who showed them a burial pit of 180 inhabitants, liquidated by the Khmer Rouge, apparently for minor infractions. But this didn't stop the troops. A week later, supported by airstrikes and artillery barrages, the column liberated Kompong Tamar, the town that sits at the top of that triangular area, and the primary checkpoint that both the forces travelling up Route 6 and 21 and 71 could meet at. It was also the stepping stone to crack on to Kompong Tom, and had been out of grasp for the first Chen La operation. Kompong Tamar, however, the city of 10,000 inhabitants or so, was left a crumbled mass of smouldering brick and craters and burning tree stumps, as once any fire had been received from the town, airstrikes, including napalm, had been deployed at the behest of the Cambodian troops on the ground. The next phase was an attempt to break the siege at Kampong Tom, the major town, the primary focus of liberating and the whole point of Chen La Tu. It was hard, brutal fighting. Diak writes that it even came down to hand-to-hand combat. But after a month, the government troops managed to link up, and the whole of Route 6 had been finally reopened. Craig Etchison, in The Rise and Demise of Democratic Kampuchea, notes, quote, "These 6 weeks were spent trying to consolidate this precarious lifeline against intermittent harassment by small enemy units. Many government troops stationed along the highway began to experience morale problems. The men were tired, casualties had been fairly heavy, and they had not had a chance to engage the enemy in a decisive battle." End quote. By early October, it seemed the North Vietnamese, Viet Cong, and Khmer Rouge had vanished. Lon Nol assumed they'd been destroyed by the airstrikes. He even removed the pins from his map that marked the North Vietnamese 9th Division and the Khmer Rouge regiments. The enemy, he announced, had been put to flight. He claimed over 3,000 enemy troops had been put out of action, 280 weapons seized, along with ammunition and latex. "The morale of the enemy is therefore very low," he said, ending his announcement with, "Now, forward to victory." On October 25th, Lon Nol declared Phase 1 of Chen La Tu not only complete, but a huge success. In Phnom Penh, there was a sigh of relief. Maybe some of that wild rhetoric that Lon Nol was banging on about had been true? During the celebrations, he said that the Khmer race had secured victory, that their religion and the way they defended themselves, that these factors were just too much for the enemy. A full 2 days of religious and military celebrations were ordered so that the troops along Route 6 could unwind before Phase 2, which would be about consolidating control of the land and the populations in this whole area and bringing them back into the functions of the government. And for the thousands of troops up and down Route 6, this was literally party time. According to Etchison, beer and opium were airlifted in for the soldiers' entertainment. But, you know, in a manner almost, if this was fiction, you'd think this is classic writing. The troops had not seemed to truly account for the fact that the local population had also disappeared, just like the communist armies. In South Vietnam, Creighton Abrams, the head of MACV, he got this report of what's going on in Cambodia, probably accompanied by the idea that this, you know, this was a big success going on over in Cambodia, and he was quite skeptical. He said, "They've opened a front 40 miles long and 2 feet wide." And the more I talk about this, you really could see this fitting into the scenes of a movie, because while Lon Nol is removing the pins that represent the communist armies off of his map and essentially saying, "We are so awesome, they've either been blown up or run away," just miles east of where all of his thousands of troops were encamped up on this road in the Cham Ka rubber plantations, which I think I said on the last episode, you know, I'm not good at geography and maps, but I tried to work it out, and I think it was basically the size of Manhattan. So you've got within that the communist headquarters, and they've been watching this whole thing. They know exactly what's going on, and most importantly, they haven't disappeared. From August 20th, so more than a month earlier, they had evacuated the civilian population along the entire 40-mile stretch of Route 6. As Etchison says, their small guerrilla units had carried out hit-and-run attacks on the Chen La Tu column, but not enough to seriously block their advance. It had all been a trap. You can almost imagine them in the dark, being able to hear the music and the celebrations wafting across the flat land and rice paddies and petering out as the sound waves break up when they begin bouncing off of the rubber trees that make up this vast, cloaked area. Because evacuating the population and beginning a period of isolated guerrilla attacks to keep the main force occupied was just phase one of the operation the communists had called Counter Chen La Tu. And phase two of this counterattack was prepared for late October, just in time for the gloating, the beer and opium-fueled celebrations that began on October 25th. Because it was late at night on the 26th. Imagine, you're a Cambodian government soldier, you've been worked so hard for months, you haven't been paid, but you've survived the fighting this far, you're finally given this chance to celebrate, you've let your hair down for two whole days, and you're finally tucked into bed, probably with maybe a bit of a headache, and that's when the communist counter-attack starts, at 1 a.m. And it was Khmer Rouge units who got things started. Remember, the Chen La Column is stretched up and down Route 6. On the bottom of that stretch, the road is leading back to Phnom Penh, at the top onto Kompong Thom. And it was on the southern side of that stretch of highway, where a main bridge provided access back to Phnom Penh. That was the first target. It explodes, completely isolating the Chen La 2 Column from resupply, reinforcement, and retreat. At the same time, the entire North Vietnamese 9th Division, supported by at least two battalions of Khmer Rouge guerrillas, crashed into the Chen La Column's centre from both sides. Imagine walking out onto the beach, into the water, and finding a very thin sandbank. And then all of a sudden, you're getting hit from both sides by waves. The already struggling government battalion north of Rum Long is wiped out in the first assault. A handful of troops escape. Similar attacks are launched at all the major areas that the government troops had encamped. It was the heaviest fighting of the war in Cambodia to date. I'll quote a few passages from Diak's book, which I really recommend, and thank you very much to friend of the show, Matt Madden, for sending me a copy. Quote, "Staggered by the shocking blows that shattered its revelry, the Cambodian government troops were subjected to unceasing attacks that kept it off balance. Weather, darkness, and chaos on the ground diluted the effectiveness of airstrikes." End quote. The government troops had been caught completely off guard, and at a low ebb, to put it lightly. Entire brigades, and these were the best troops Lon Nol had, by the way, vanished into the mud. The communist offensive was cutting this long snake of the Chen La 2 column into segments, isolating each one and wearing them down. In one horribly sad extra part of this story, you might recall how, just as with the Chen La 1 operation, many of the soldiers embarking on the offensive had also brought their wives and children, girlfriends, along because they didn't have a place to stay and be supported. So they were tagging along with the operation. And, well, I'll refer back to Diak's reading of events. Quote, "The 63rd and 425th Battalions of the 61st Infantry Brigade pulled back to the position held by the 22nd Battalion just south of Rum Long, now surrounded by four North Vietnamese regiments. A four-day hell of gunfire and explosions tore into the flesh of women and children, as well as into the soldier husbands and fathers they had counted on for food and shelter." End quote. He goes on to say that the fighting, with the Chen La column sliced into pieces and dying, well, didn't die easily. Air supply drops were too little and too widely scattered to do more than prolong the agony of the exhausted and dispirited army, which was losing a reported 100 men a day. Throughout the entire month of November, as the dry monsoon season began, the isolated bands of troops fell one by one. Eventually, those who weren't slaughtered or captured for an unknown fate began to desert into the countryside, trying to make their way back to their homes or somehow get out of enemy territory alive. On December 3rd, the communist counter-Chen La 2 operation concluded as the last government outpost was overrun. Cambodian Army General Sak Sutsakan called it the greatest catastrophe of the war, assessing the government losses at around 10 battalions of personnel and equipment. The communists claimed that more than 12,000 of Lon Nol's troops had been killed, wounded, or captured during the campaign. So what was the aftermath to this disaster? Well, if you recall, last episode we spoke about Etchison's various stages of the seven-act tragedy that was the Khmer Republic. And you might remember Chen La 2 was under the stage of blunder. And while this military defeat was massive, it should also be mentioned that over this same time period back in Phnom Penh, there were also a series of terrorist attacks rocking various parts of the city in increasing frequency. For instance, on Sunday, September 26th, huge black plumes of smoke erupted in the northern part of the city after three communist commandos dressed in Lon Nol uniforms threw an explosive charge at a group of fuel barges parked on the river. Meanwhile, in the south, at a soccer field near the US Embassy, a crowd had gathered to watch a softball game that was usually played by the embassy staff on Sunday afternoons. Suddenly, two men tossed explosives into the playing field. Two Americans were killed while 10 other personnel were wounded, and in the crowd, a Cambodian child died instantly, as others were injured. Diak points out that this would be the same field that the Americans would abandon Cambodia from on April 12, 1975, in Operation Eagle Pool, as the Khmer Rouge siege of the city reached its climax. But this was just one example of the numerous terrorist attacks that had ramped up since June. So, by the end of the year, you have this massive military defeat out in the field, but you also have an increasing sense of unease in the capital. While the areas that were under government control seemed to keep shrinking. Highway 4, which had opened up at the start of the year, was cut off once again. Cambodia's situation seemed bleaker than ever. In private, Lon Nol had blamed the US for the Chen La Tu debacle, saying they had insufficiently supported the campaign. While the defeat significantly undermined American optimism in Lon Nol's leadership, but it was just like in the wake of his stroke. The same characters, like Sirik Matak, tried to persuade the field marshal to give up his personal direction of the military, but also his leadership of the government. Lon Nol refused, no doubt with Little Brother backing him up, and again, he blamed the US for Chen La Tu and continued to tighten the number of those who had access to his inner circle. And it just comes back to what we discussed at the start of the episode. The kingmaker here, the US, did not act. They did not seriously reassess their policy for the Khmer Republic, despite knowing full well that Lon Nol had become a liability. And in fact, the embassy was instructed not to send negative reports about Lon Nol around. There had been an embarrassing leak of one cable where Ambassador Swank referred to Lon Nol as a sick man, mentally and physically. Everything that had gone wrong with Chen La Tu, and if we think about it, like Lon Nol as the director, you know, he had tanked that movie. But the studio talked about it like it was nothing. The chairman of the US Joint Chiefs of Staff visited Phnom Penh and presented Lon Nol with a cowboy pistol as if it was a celebration of a victory. Not long after, Nixon proclaimed that Cambodia, receiving about a third of $1 billion a year, was the Nixon Doctrine in its purest form. So Lon Nol was going nowhere. He had arranged the government to work as a military dictatorship, and as Chandler frames Nixon's comment there, this basically meant that Cambodians, not Americans, were dying. And if that was the Nixon doctrine, it was perhaps working purely in Cambodia, as the burden of fighting was shifted off of the Americans and onto its allies. And as a direct example of this, you know, this huge defeat for the Lon Nol regime had actually translated into a win for Vietnamization in South Vietnam, or it would. The North Vietnamese 1st, 7th, and 9th Battalions, that had been so deadly against the Chen La Column, had basically, by participating in this counter-Chen La Tu operation, had kind of been weakened and kind of prevented from fully participating in the communist offensive planned for South Vietnam in the first quarter of 1972. This was apparently a decisive part of the failure of this spring offensive. So, if that was the aim with the whole Cambodian endeavor, which it was, well, sadly, it was working toward those American objectives, just not Cambodian ones. Chen La Tu was the last major offensive undertaken by the Lon Nol regime. From the end of 1971 onward, the government would only be on the defensive, and its military capacity with so much of it destroyed in those last months of the year, would never recover to the levels beforehand. And it's hard not to point the finger directly at the men at the top, because we can't say that those who had fought in these battles hadn't done so to the best of their ability, but it had been the leadership that failed them. Which is why, at the beginning of this episode, I really tried to stress that fork in the road that I think emerged when Lon Nol suffered his stroke. I think that was, among many, but a truly decisive moment to have not made a move, and in this instance to have made a move that got rid of him. And now, it will be another 3 years of largely pointless death and destruction that will only usher in an entirely different nightmare. Because at the beginning of 1972, the Khmer Rouge had emerged as an independent fighting force. The communist triumph that destroyed Chen La Tu provided an example to the North Vietnamese that Lon Nol's regime was dead in the water. And they turned their attention back to South Vietnam. The Khmer Rouge, already the benefactors of all of the administrative growth and territory and training of their cadres and army that had been going on since mid-1970, were now able to assume the role of the primary opponent to the Khmer Republic. They held the countryside, and they had tens of thousands of troops, and it was from this point on that the Vietnam War in Cambodia became the Cambodian Civil War.